elbowing each other and cackling, all except for one of them. She was the drunkest and youngest looking of them all, ready to throw up if he knew anything about it. She stumbled on her heels, falling slightly behind her friends, a silly little tart. None of her friends had realized what a state she was in. They were just the right side of legless, snorting and guffawing as they staggered along. He drifted after them, casual as you please. If she threw up in the street, the noise would attract her friends, who would stop and rally around her. While she fought the urge to vomit, she could not speak. Slowly, the distance between her and her friends increased. She swayed and wobbled, reminding him of the last one with her stupid high heels. This one must not survive to help make photo fits. A taxi was approaching. He saw the scenario play out before it did. They hailed it loudly, screeching and waving their arms, and in they piled one by one, fat ass after fat ass. He sped up, head down, face hidden. The street lamps reflected in the puddles, the for-hire light extinguished, the growl of the engine. They had forgotten her. She swayed right into the wall, holding up an arm to support herself. He might only have seconds. One of her friends would realize any time now that she wasn't with them.
"You all right, darling? You feeling bad? Come here. This way. You'll be all right. Just down here."
She began to retch as he tugged her down a side street. Feebly, she tried to pull her arm away, heaving. The vomit splattered down her, gagging her.
"Filthy bitch," he snarled,
one hand already on the handle of his knife under the jacket. He was dragging her forcibly towards a darkened recess between an adult video store and a junk shop.
"No,"
she gasped, but she choked on her vomit, heaving. A door opened across the street, light rippling down a flight of steps. People burst out onto the pavement, laughing. He slammed her up against the wall and kissed her, pinning her flat while she tried to struggle. She tasted foul, of sick. The door opposite closed, the gaggle of people passed by, their voices echoing in the quiet night, the light extinguished.
"Fucking hell,"
he said in disgust, releasing her mouth, but keeping her pinned to the wall with his body. She drew breath to scream, but he had the knife ready, and it sank deep between her ribs with ease. Nothing like the last one, who'd fought so hard and so stubbornly. The noise died on her stained lips as the hot blood poured over his gloved hand, soaking the material. She jerked convulsively, tried to speak, her eyes rolled upwards into whiteness, and her entire body sagged, still pinned by the knife.
"Good girl," he whispered,
pulling the carving knife free as she fell, dying, into his arms. He dragged her deeper into the recess, where a pile of rubbish sat waiting for collection. Kicking the black bags aside, he dumped her in a corner, then pulled out his machete. Souvenirs were imperative, but he only had seconds. Another door might open, or her dozy bitches of friends might come back in their taxi. He slashed and sawed, put his warm, oozing trophies in his pocket, then piled up the rubbish over and on her. It had taken less than 5 minutes. He felt like a king, like a god. Away he walked, knives safely stowed, panting in the cool, clean night air, jogging a little once he was on the main road again. He was already a block away when he heard raucous female voices shouting in the distance.
"Heather! Heather, where are you, you silly cow?"
"Heather can't hear you," he whispered into the darkness.
He tried to stop himself laughing, burying his face in his collar, but he could not restrain his jubilation. Deep in his pockets, his sopping fingers were playing with the rubbery cartilage and skin, to which her earrings, little plastic ice cream cones, were still attached. Chapter 49. It's the time in the season for a maniac at night. Blue Oyster Cult, madness to the method. The weather remained cool, rain-flecked and faintly blustery, as June entered its second week. The blaze of sunlit pageantry that had surrounded the royal wedding had receded into memory. The giddy high tide of romantic fervour had ebbed. The wedding merchandise and congratulatory banners had been removed from shop windows, and the capital's newspapers returned to more mundane matters, including an imminent tube strike. Then horror exploded across Wednesday's front pages. The mutilated body of a young woman had been uncovered beneath bin bags, and within a few hours of the first police appeal for information, the world had been informed that a 21st century Jack the Ripper was stalking the streets of London. Three women had been attacked and mutilated, but the Met appeared to have no leads. In their stampede to cover every possible aspect of the story, maps of London showing the location of each attack, pictures of the three victims, the journalists revealed themselves determined to make up for lost time, aware that they might have arrived a little late at the party. They had previously treated the killing of Kelsey Platt as a lone act of madness and sadism, and the subsequent attack on Lila Monckton, the 18-year-old prostitute, had gained virtually no media coverage. A girl who had been selling herself for sex on the day of the royal wedding could hardly expect to oust a new-minted duchess from the front pages. The murder of Heather Smart, a 22-year-old building society employee from Nottingham, was an entirely different matter. The headlines virtually wrote themselves, for Heather was a wonderfully relatable heroine, with her steady job, her innocent desire to see the capital's landmarks, and a boyfriend who was a primary school teacher. Heather had been to see the Lion King the night before her death, had eaten dim sum in Chinatown, and posed for photographs in Hyde Park, with the lifeguards riding past in the background. Endless column inches could be spun out of the long weekend to celebrate her sister-in-law's 30th birthday, which had culminated in a brutal, sordid death in the back lot of an adult entertainment store. The story, like all the best stories, split like an amoeba, forming an endless series of news stories and opinion pieces and speculative articles, each spawning its own counter-chorus. There were discussions of the deplorable drunken tendencies of the young British woman, with reciprocal accusations of victim-blaming. There were horror-struck articles about sexual violence, tempered with reminders that these attacks were far less common than in other countries. There were interviews with the distraught, guilt-stricken friends who had accidentally abandoned Heather, which in turn spawned attacks and vilifications on social media, leading back to a defense of the grieving young women. Overlaying every story was the shadow of the unknown killer, the madman who was hacking women's bodies apart. The press again descended upon Denmark Street, in search of the man who had received Kelsey's leg. Strike decided that the time had come for Robin to take that much-discussed but daily postponed trip to Matham for a final fitting of her wedding dress, then decamped yet again to Nick and Ilse's with a backpack and a crushing sense of his own impotence. A plainclothes officer remained stationed in Denmark Street in case anything suspicious turned up in the post. Wardle was concerned lest another body part addressed to Robin arrived. Weighed down by the demands of an investigation that was being conducted under the full glare of the national media, Wardle was unable to meet Strike face to face for 6 days after the discovery of Heather's body. Strike journeyed again to the Feathers in the early evening, where he found Wardle looking haggard, but looking forward to talking things over with a man who was both inside and outside the case.
"Been a fucker of a week," sighed Wardle, accepting the pint Strike had bought him. "I've started bloody smoking again. April's really pissed off."
He took a long draught of beer, then shared with Strike the truth about the discovery of Heather's body. The press stories, as Strike had already noted, conflicted in many possibly important essentials, though all blamed the police for not finding her for 24 hours.
"She and her friends were all shit-faced," said the policeman, setting the scene with bluntness. "Four of them got into a cab, so ratted they forgot about Heather. They were a street away when they realised she wasn't with them. The cabbies hacked off because they are loud and obnoxious. One of them starts swearing at him when he says he can't do a U-turn in the middle of the road. There's a big argument, so it's a good 5 minutes before he agrees to go back for Heather. When they finally reach the street where they think they left her, they're from Nottingham, remember? They don't know London at all. Heather's nowhere to be seen. They crawl up the road in the cab, shouting for her out of the open window. Then one of them thinks she sees Heather in the distance getting onto a bus. So two of them get out. There's no bloody logic to it, they were out of their skulls. And go running down the road screaming after the bus to stop, while the other two lean out of the cab screaming at them to get back in. They should follow the bus in the cab. Then, the one who got into an argument with the cabbie earlier calls him a stupid packy. He tells them to get the fuck out of his cab and drives away. So basically, said Wardle wearily, all this shit we're taking for not finding her within 24 hours is down to alcohol and racism. The silly bitches were convinced Heather had got on that bus, so we wasted a day and a half trying to track a woman wearing a similar coat. Then the owner of the adult entertainment centre goes to put his bins out and finds her lying there under a load of bags, nose and ears cut off. So that bit was true, said Strike. Her mutilated face had been the one detail all of the papers had agreed on. Yeah, that bit was true, said Wardle heavily. The Shacklewell Ripper. It's got a great ring to it. Witnesses? Nobody saw a bloody thing. What about devotee and his motorbike? Ruled out, Wardle admitted, his expression grim. He's got a firm alibi for Heather's killing, family wedding, and we couldn't make anything stick for either of the other two attacks. Strike had the impression that Wardle wanted to tell him something else, and waited receptively. I don't want the press to get wind of this, Wardle said, dropping his voice. But we think he might have done two more. Jesus, said Strike, genuinely alarmed. When? Historic, said Wardle. Unsolved murder in Leeds, 2009. Prostitute, originally from Cardiff, stabbed. He didn't cut anything off her, but he took a necklace she always wore and dumped her in a ditch out of town. The body wasn't found for a fortnight. Then last year, a girl was killed and mutilated in Milton Keynes. Sadie Roach, her name was. Her boyfriend went down for it. I've looked it all up. The family campaigned hard for his release and he got out on appeal. There was nothing to tie him to it, except that they'd rowed and he once threatened a bloke with a penknife. We've got the psychologist and forensics onto all five attacks, and the conclusion is they've got enough features in common to suggest the same perpetrator. It looks like he uses two knives, a carving knife and a machete. The victims were all vulnerable, prostitutes, drunk, emotionally off balance, and all picked up off the street except for Kelsey. He took trophies from all of them. It's too soon to say whether we've got any similar DNA off the women. Odds are not. It doesn't look like he had sex with any of them. He gets his kicks a different way. Strike was hungry, but something told him not to interrupt Wardle's moody silence. The policeman drank more beer, then said, without quite meeting Strike's eyes, I'm looking into all your guys, Brockbank, Lang, and Whittaker. About fucking time. Brockbank's interesting, said Wardle. You found him? Asked Strike, freezing with his pint at his lips. Not yet, but we know he was a regular attendee at a church in Brixton until 5 weeks ago. Church? Are you sure it's the same bloke? Tall ex-soldier, ex-rugby player, long jaw, one of his eyes sunken, cauliflower ear, dark crew cut, reeled off Wardle. Same Noel Brockbank, 6'3" or 6'4", strong northern accent. That's him, said Strike. A bloody church. Hang on, said Wardle, getting up. Need a slash. And yet, why not a church? Strike thought, as he went to the bar for a couple of fresh pints. The pub was filling up around him. He took a menu back to the table as well as the beers, but could not concentrate on it. Young girls in the choir. He wouldn't be the first. Needed that, said Wardle, rejoining Strike. I might go out for a fag. Join you back. Finish about Brockbank first, said Strike, pushing the fresh pint across the table. To tell you the truth, we found him by accident, said Wardle, sitting back down and accepting the pint. One of our guys has been tailing the mother of a local drug lord. We don't think Mum's as innocent as she's claiming to be. So our guy follows her to church and there's Brockbank standing on the door handing out hymn books. He got talking to the copper without knowing who he was, and our guy didn't have a clue Brockbank was wanted in connection with anything. 4 weeks later, our guy hears me talking about looking for a Noel Brockbank on the Kelsey Platt case and tells me he met a bloke with the same name a month ago in Brixton. See? Said Wardle, with a ghost of his usual smirk. I do pay attention to your tip-off strike. Be silly not to after the Landry case. You pay attention when you've got nothing out of Digger Malley and Devotee, thought Strike. But he made impressed and grateful noises before returning to the main point. Did you say Brockbank stopped attending church? Yeah, said Wardle. I went down there yesterday, had a word with the vicar. Young guy, enthusiastic, inner city church, you know the sort, said Wardle, inaccurately, because Strike's contact with the clergy had been mostly limited to military chaplains. He had a lot of time for Brockbank. Said he'd had a rough deal in life. Brain damage, invalided out of the army, lost his family, all that crap. Asked Strike. That was the gist, said Wardle. Said he misses his son. Uh-huh, said Strike darkly. Did he know where Brockbank was living? No, but apparently his girlfriend, Elisa. Frowning slightly, Wardle reached into the inside pocket of his jacket, pulled out a notebook and consulted it. Yeah, it is as it goes, he said. Elisa Vincent. How did you know that? They've both just been sacked from a strip club. I'll explain in a bit, said Strike hurriedly, as Wardle showed signs of becoming sidetracked. Go on about Elisa. Well, she's managed to get a council house in East London near her mother. Brockbank told the vicar he was going to move in with her and the kids. Kids? Said Strike, his thoughts flying to Robin. Two little girls, apparently. Do we know where this house is? Asked Strike. Not yet. The vicar was sorry to see him go, said Wardle, glancing restlessly towards the pavement, where a couple of men were smoking. I did get out of him that Brockbank was in church on Sunday the 3rd of April, which was the weekend Kelsey died. In view of Wardle's increasing restlessness, Strike passed no comment except to suggest that they both adjourn to the pavement for a cigarette. They lit up and smoked side by side for a couple of minutes. Workers walked past in both directions, weary from late hours at the office. Evening was drawing in. Directly above them, between the indigo of approaching night and the neon coral of the setting sun, was a narrow stretch of no-coloured sky, a vapid and empty air. "Christ, I've missed this," said Wardle, dragging on the cigarette as though it was mother's milk, before picking up the thread of their conversation once more. Yeah, so Brockbank was in church that weekend making himself useful. Very good with the kids, apparently. I'll bet he is, muttered Strike. Would take some nerve, though, wouldn't it? Said Wardle, blowing smoke towards the opposite side of the road, his eyes on Epstein's sculpture, Day, which adorned the old London transport offices. A boy stood before a throned man, his body contorted so that he both managed to embrace the king behind him and display his own penis to onlookers. To kill and dismember a girl, then turn up in church as though nothing had happened. Are you Catholic? Strike asked. Wardle looked startled. I am, as it goes, he said suspiciously. Why? Strike shook his head, smiling slightly. I know a psycho wouldn't care, said Wardle, with a trace of defensiveness. I'm just saying. Anyway, we've got people trying to find out where he's living now. If it's a council house, and assuming Elisa Vincent's her real name, it shouldn't be too difficult. Great, said Strike. The police had resources that he and Robin could not match. Perhaps now, at last, some definitive information would be forthcoming. What about Lang? Ah, said Wardle, grinding out his first cigarette and immediately lighting another. We've got more on him. He's been living alone in Wollaston Close for 18 months now. Survives on disability benefits. He had a chest infection over the weekend of the 2nd and 3rd, and his friend Dickie came in to help him out. He couldn't get to the shops.
That's bloody convenient, said Strike.
Or genuine, said Wardle. We checked with Dickie, and he confirmed everything Lang told us. Was Lang surprised the police were asking about his movements?
Seemed pretty taken aback at first. Did he let you in the flat?
Didn't arise. We met him crossing the car park on his sticks, and we ended up talking to him in a local cafe.
That Ecuadorian place in the tunnel.
Wardle subjected Strike to a hard stare that the detective returned with equanimity. You've been stalking him out as well, have you?
Don't mess this up for us, Strike. We're on it.
Strike might have responded that it had taken press scrutiny and the failure to make anything of his preferred leads to make Wardle commit serious resources to the tracking of Strike's three suspects. He chose to hold his silence.
Lang's not stupid, Wardle continued. We hadn't been questioning him long when he twigged what it was about. He knew you must have given us his name. He'd seen in the papers you got sent a leg. What was his view on the matter?
There might have been an undertone of couldn't happen to a nicer bloke, said Wardle with a slight grin. But on balance about what you'd expect. Bit of curiosity, bit of defensiveness.
Did he look ill?
Yeah, said Wardle. He didn't know we were coming, and we met him shambling along on his sticks. He doesn't look good close up, bloodshot eyes, his skin's kind of cracked, bit of a mess. Strike said nothing. His mistrust of Lang's illness lingered. In spite of the clear photographic evidence of steroid use, skin plaques and lesions that Strike had seen with his own eyes, he found himself stubbornly resistant to the idea that Lang was genuinely ill.
What was he doing when the other women were killed?
Says he was home alone, said Wardle. Nothing to prove or disprove it.
Hmm, said Strike.
They turned back into the pub. A couple had taken their table, so they found another beside the floor-to-ceiling window onto the street.
What about Whittaker?
Yeah, we caught up with him last night. He's roadieing for a band.
Are you sure about that?
Said Strike suspiciously, remembering Shanker's assertion that Whittaker claimed to be doing so, but was in fact living off Stephanie.
Yeah, I'm sure. We called in on the druggy girlfriend. Get inside the flat.
She talked to us at the door, unsurprisingly, said Wardle. The place stinks. Anyway, she told us he was off with the boys, gave us the address of the concert, and there he was. Old transit van parked outside, and an even older band. Ever heard of Death Cult?
No, said Strike. Don't bother, they're shit, said Wardle. I had to sit through half an hour of the stuff before I could get near Whittaker. Basement of a pub in Wandsworth. I had tinnitus all the next day.
Whittaker seemed to be half expecting us, said Wardle. Apparently he found you outside his van a few weeks ago.
I told you about that, said Strike. Crack fumes.
Yeah, yeah, said Wardle. Look, I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him. But he reckons Stephanie can give him an alibi for the whole day of the royal wedding, so that would rule out the attack on the hooker in Shacklewell. And he claims he was off with Death Cult when both Kelsey and Heather were killed.
All three killings covered, eh? Said Strike. That's neat. The Death Cult agree he was with them.
They were pretty vague about it, to be honest, said Wardle. The lead singer's got a hearing aid. I don't know whether he caught everything I asked him. Don't worry, I've got guys checking all their witness statements, he added, in the face of Strike's frown. We'll find out whether he was really there or not. Wardle yawned and stretched.
I've got to get back to the office, he said. This could be an all-nighter. We've got a load of information coming in now the papers are onto it.
Strike was extremely hungry now, but the pub was noisy, and he felt he would rather eat somewhere he could think. He and Wardle headed up the road together, both lighting fresh cigarettes as they walked.
The psychologist raised something, said Wardle, as the curtain of darkness unrolled across the sky above them.
If we're right, and we're dealing with a serial killer. He's usually an opportunist. He's got a bloody good MO. He must be a planner to a degree, or he couldn't have got away with it so often. But there was a change in the pattern with Kelsey. He knew exactly where she was staying. The letters and the fact that he knew there wouldn't be anyone there. It was totally premeditated. Trouble is, we've had a bloody good look, but we can't find any evidence that any of your guys have ever been in proximity with her. We virtually took her laptop apart, and there was nothing there. The only people she ever talked to about her legs were those oddballs Jason and Tempest. She had hardly any friends, and the ones she did have were all girls. There was nothing suspicious on her phone. As far as we know, none of your guys has ever lived or worked in Finchley or Shepherd's Bush, let alone gone anywhere near her school or college. They've got no known connection with any of her associates. How the hell could any of them get close enough to manipulate her without her family noticing?
We know she was duplicitous, said Strike. Don't forget the pretend boyfriend who turned out to be pretty real when he picked her up from Café Rouge.
Yeah, sighed Wardle. We've still got no leads on that bloody bike. We've put out a description in the press, but nothing. How's your partner? He added, pausing outside the glass doors of his place of work, but apparently determined to smoke the cigarette down to the last millimetre. Not too shaken up.
She's fine, said Strike. She's back in Yorkshire for a wedding dress fitting. I made her take the time off. She's been working through the weekend a lot lately.
Robin had left without complaint. What was there to stay for, with the press staking out Denmark Street, one lousy paying job, and the police now covering Brockbank, Lang and Whittaker more efficiently than the agency ever could?
Good luck, said Strike as he and Wardle parted.
The policeman raised a hand in acknowledgement and farewell, and disappeared into the large building behind the slowly revolving prism, glittering with the words, New Scotland Yard. Strike strolled back towards the tube, craving a kebab, and inwardly deliberating the problem that Wardle had just put to him. How could any of his suspects have got close enough to Kelsey Platt to know her movements or gain her trust? He thought about Lang, living alone in his grim Wollaston close flat, claiming his disability benefit, overweight and infirm, looking far older than his real age of 34. He had been a funny man once. Did he still have it in him to charm a young girl to the point that she would have ridden on motorbikes with him or taken him trustingly to a flat in Shepherd's Bush, about which her family knew nothing? What about Whittaker, stinking of crack, with his blackened teeth and his thinning matted hair? True, Whittaker had once had mesmeric charm, and emaciated, drug-addicted Stephanie seemed to find him appealing. But Kelsey's only known passion had been for a clean-cut blonde boy, just a few years older than herself. Then there was Brockbank. To Strike, the massive, swarthy ex-flanker was downright repulsive, as unlike pretty Niall as it was possible to be. Brockbank had been living and working miles from Kelsey's home and work, and while both had attended churches, their places of worship were on opposite banks of the Thames. The police would surely have unearthed any contact between the two congregations by now. Did the absence of any known connection between Kelsey and Strike's three suspects rule each of them out as the killer? While logic seemed to urge the answer yes, something stubborn inside Strike continued to whisper no. Chapter 50. I'm out of my place. I'm out of my mind. Blue Oyster Cult, Celestial the Queen. Robin's trip home was tinged throughout with the strangest sense of unreality. She felt out of step with everybody, even her mother, who was preoccupied with the wedding arrangements and, while sympathetic to Robin's constant checking of her phone for any development on the Shacklewell Ripper, a little harassed. Back in the familiar kitchen where Roundtree snoozed at her feet, the seating plan for the reception
spread out on the scrubbed wooden table between them, Robin began to appreciate how fully she had abnegated responsibility for her wedding. Linda was constantly firing questions at her about favours, speeches, the bridesmaid's shoes, her headdress, when it would be convenient to speak to the vicar, where she and Matt wanted the present sent, whether Matthew's Auntie Sue ought to be on the top table or not. Robin had imagined that being at home would be restful. Instead, she was required to deal, on the one hand, with a tidal wave of trivial queries from her mother, on the other, a series of questions from her brother Martin, who pored over accounts of the discovery of Heather Smart's body, until Robin lost her temper with what she saw as his ghoulishness, whereupon an overwrought Linda banned all mention of the killer from their house. Matthew, meanwhile, was angry, though trying not to show it, that Robin had not yet asked Strike for 2 weeks off for the honeymoon. "I'm sure it'll be fine," said Robin at dinner. "We've got hardly any work on, and Cormoran says the police have taken over all our leads." "He still hasn't confirmed," said Linda, who had been beadily watching how little Robin was eating.
"Who hasn't?" asked Robin.
"Strike. No RSVP.
"I'll remind him," said Robin, taking a large slug of wine.
She had not told any of them, not even Matthew, that she kept having nightmares that woke her gasping in the darkness, back in the bed where she had slept in the months following her rape. A massive man kept coming for her in these dreams. Sometimes he burst into the office where she worked with Strike. More frequently, he loomed out of the darkness in the back streets of London, knives shining. That morning, he had been on the point of gouging out her eyes when she woke, gasping, to the sound of Matthew drowsily asking her what she had said.
"Nothing," she had said, pushing sweaty hair off her forehead. "Nothing."
Matthew had to return to work on Monday. He seemed pleased to leave her behind in Massam, helping Linda with preparations for the wedding. Mother and daughter met the vicar at St. Mary the Virgin for a final discussion about the form of the service on Monday afternoon. Robin tried hard to concentrate on the minister's cheerful suggestions, his ecclesiastical pep talk. But all the time he was talking, her eyes kept drifting to the large stone crab that appeared to be clinging to the church wall on the right of the aisle. This crab had fascinated her in her childhood. She had not been able to understand why there was a big carved crab crawling up the stones of their church, and her curiosity on the point had ended up infecting Linda, who had gone to the local library, looked up the records, and triumphantly informed her daughter that the crab had been the emblem of the ancient Scrope family, whose memorial sat above it. 9-year-old Robin had been disappointed by the answer. In a way, an explanation had never been the point. She had simply liked being the only one who wanted to find out the truth. She was standing in the dressmaker's box-like changing room, with its gilt-framed mirror and its new carpet smell, when Strike called next day. Robin knew that it was Strike because of the unique ringtone that she had attached to his calls. She lunged for her handbag, causing the dressmaker to emit a little cry of annoyance and surprise as the folds of chiffon that she was dexterously repinning were torn from her hands.
"Hello?" said Robin.
"Hi," said Strike.
The single syllable told her that something bad had happened.
"Oh God, has someone else been killed?"
Robin blurted out, forgetting the dressmaker crouching at the hem of her wedding dress. The woman stared at her in the mirror, her mouth full of pins.
"Sorry, could you give me a moment?
Not you," she added to Strike in case he hung up.
"Sorry,"
she repeated, as the curtain closed behind the dressmaker and she sank down onto the stool in the corner in her wedding dress.
"I was with someone. Has someone else died?"
"Yes," said Strike. "But it's not what you think. It's Wardle's brother."
Robin's tired and overwrought brain tried to join dots that refused to connect.
"It's nothing to do with the case," said Strike. "He was knocked down on a zebra crossing by a speeding van."
"God,"
said Robin, utterly fazed. She had temporarily forgotten that death came in any manner other than at the hands of a maniac with knives.
It's a fucker, all right. He had 3 kids and a 4th on the way. I've just spoken to Wardle. Bloody terrible thing to happen.
Robin's brain seemed to grind back into gear again. So is Wardle...
Compassionate leave, said Strike. Guess who's taken over from him?
Not Anstis, Robin asked, suddenly worried.
Worse than that, said Strike.
Not Carver, said Robin, with a sudden presentiment of doom. Of the policemen whom Strike had managed to offend and upstage during his 2 most famous detective triumphs, Detective Inspector Roy Carver had been the most comprehensively outclassed and was consequently the most deeply embittered. His failings during the investigation into a famous model's fall from a penthouse flat had been extensively documented and indeed exaggerated in the press. A sweaty man with dandruff and a mottled purple face like corned beef, he had had an antipathy towards Strike even before the detective had publicly proven that the policeman had failed to spot murder.
Right in one, said Strike. I've just had him here for 3 hours.
Oh, God, why?
Come off it, said Strike. You know why. This is a wet dream for Carver, having an excuse to interrogate me about a series of murders. He stopped just short of asking me for alibis, and he spent a hell of a lot of time on those fake letters to Kelsey.
Robin groaned. Why on earth would they let Carver? I mean, with his record.
Hard though it might be for us to believe, he hasn't been a dickhead his entire career. His bosses must think he was unlucky with Landry. It's supposed to be only temporary while Wardle's off, but he's already warned me to stay well away from the investigation. When I asked how inquiries into Brookbank, Lang and Whittaker were going, he as good as told me to fuck off with my ego and my hunches. We'll be getting no more inside information on the progress of the case, I can promise you that.
He'll have to follow up Wardle's lines of investigation, though, said Robin. Won't he?
Given that he'd clearly rather chop off his own knob than let me solve another of his cases, you'd think he'd be careful to follow up all my leads. Trouble is, I can tell he's rationalised the Landry case as me getting lucky. And I reckon he thinks me coming up with 3 suspects in this case is pure showboating. I wish to hell, said Strike, we'd got an address for Brockbank before Wardle had to leave.
As Robin had been silent for a whole minute while she listened to Strike, the dressmaker clearly thought it reasonable to check whether she was ready to resume the fitting, and poked her head in through the curtain. Robin, whose expression was suddenly beatific, waved her away impatiently. "We have got an address for Brockbank," Robin told Strike, in a triumphant voice as the curtain swung closed again.
"What?"
"I didn't tell you because I thought Wardle would already have got it, but I thought, just in case, I've been ringing around local nurseries pretending I was Elisa, Zahara's mum. I said I wanted to check they had our new address, right? One of them read it out to me off the parent contact sheet. They're living on Blondin Street in Bow."
"Jesus Christ, Robin, that's fucking brilliant."
When the dressmaker returned to her job at last, she found a considerably more radiant bride than she had left. Robin's lack of enthusiasm for the process of altering her dress had been diminishing the seamstress's pleasure in her job. Robin was easily the best-looking client on her books, and she had hoped to get a photograph for advertising purposes once the dress was finished.
"That's wonderful," said Robin, beaming at the seamstress as she tugged the last seam straight, and together they contemplated the vision in the mirror. "That's absolutely wonderful."
For the first time, she thought that the dress really didn't look bad at all. Chapter 51. Don't turn your back, don't show your profile. You'll never know when it's your turn to go. Blue Oyster Cult, don't turn your back.
The public response has been overwhelming. We're currently following up over 1,200 leads, some of which look promising, said Detective Inspector Roy Carver. We continue to appeal for information on the whereabouts of the red Honda CB750 used to transport part of Kelsey Platt's body, and we remain interested in speaking to anybody who was in Old Street on the night of the 5th of June, when Heather Smart was killed. The headline, Police Follow New Leads in Hunt for Shacklewell Ripper, was not really justified, in Robin's view, by anything in the brief report beneath, although she supposed that Carver would not share details of genuine new developments with the press. Five photographs of the women now believed to have been victims of the Ripper filled most of the page, their identities and their brutal fates stamped across their chests in black typeface. Martina Rossi, 28, prostitute, stabbed to death, necklace stolen. Martina was a plump, dark woman wearing a white tank top. Her blurry photograph looked as though it had been a selfie. A small, heart-shaped harp charm hung from a chain around her neck. Sadie Roach, 25, admin assistant, stabbed to death, mutilated, earrings taken. She had been a pretty girl with a gamin haircut and hoops in her ears. Judging by the cropped figures at the edges of her picture, it had been taken at a family gathering. Kelsey Platt, 16, student, stabbed to death and dismembered. Here was the familiar, chubby, plain face of the girl who had written to strike, smiling in her school uniform. Lila Monkton, 18, prostitute, stabbed, fingers cut off, survived. A blurred picture of a gaunt girl whose bright red hennaed hair was cut into a shaggy bob, her multiple piercings glinting in the camera flash. Heather Smart, 22, financial services worker, stabbed to death, nose and ears removed. She was round-faced and innocent-looking, with wavy mouse-brown hair, freckles, and a timid smile. Robin looked up from the Daily Express with a deep sigh. Matthew had been sent to audit a client in High Wycombe, so he had been unable to give Robin a lift today. It had taken her a full hour and 20 minutes to get to Catford from Ealing, on trains crammed with tourists and commuters sweating in the London heat. Now she left her seat and headed for the door, swaying with the rest of the commuters as the train slowed and stopped, yet again, at Catford Bridge Station. Her week back at work with Strike had been strange. Strike, who clearly had no intention to comply with the instructions to keep out of Carver's investigation, was nevertheless taking the investigating officer seriously enough to be cautious.
If he can make a case that we've buggered up the police investigation, we're finished as a business, he said. And we know he'll try and say I've screwed things up, whether I have or not.
So why are we carrying on? Robin had been playing devil's advocate because she would have been deeply unhappy and frustrated had Strike announced that they were abandoning their leads. Because Carver thinks my suspects are bullshit and I think he's an incompetent tit. Robin's laugh had ended prematurely when Strike had told her he wanted her to return to Catford and stake out Whittaker's girlfriend. Still? She asked. Why?
You know why. I want to see whether Stephanie can give him alibis for any of the key dates.
You know what? Said Robin, plucking up her courage. I've been in Catford a lot. If it's all the same to you, I'd rather do Brockbank. Why don't I try and get something out of Elisa?
There's Lang as well, if you want to change, said Strike.
He saw me up close when I fell over, Robin countered at once. Don't you think it would be better if you did Lang?
I've been watching his flat while you've been away, Strike said.
And?
And he mostly stays in, but sometimes he goes to the shops and back.
You don't think it's him anymore, do you?
I haven't ruled him out, said Strike. Why are you so keen to do Brockbank?
Well, said Robin bravely, I feel like I've done a lot of the running on him. I got the Market Harborough address out of Holly, and I got Blondin Street out of the nursery,
and you're worried about the kids who are living with him, said Strike.
Robin remembered the little black girl with the stiff pigtails
who had tripped over, staring at her, in Catford Broadway. So what if I am?
I'd rather you stuck to Stephanie, said Strike. She had been annoyed. So annoyed that she had promptly asked for 2 weeks off rather more bluntly than she might otherwise have done. 2 weeks off? He said, looking up in surprise. He was far more used to her begging to stay at work than asking to leave it.
It's for my honeymoon.
Oh, he said. Right, yeah, I suppose that'll be soon, will it?
Obviously, the wedding's on the 2nd.
Christ, that's only, what, 3 weeks or summer?
She had been annoyed that he had not realised that it was so close. Yes, she had said, getting to her feet and reaching for her jacket. And would you mind RSVPing if you're coming? So she returned to Catford and the busy market stalls, to the smell of incense and raw fish, to pointless hours of standing beneath the crouching stone bears over the stage door of the Broadway theatre. Robin had hidden her hair under a straw hat today and was wearing sunglasses, but she still wondered whether she did not see a hint of recognition in the eyes of stallholders as she settled once more to lurk opposite the triple windows of Whittaker and Stephanie's flat. She had only had a couple of glimpses of the girl since she had resumed her surveillance on her, and on neither occasion had there been the slightest chance of speaking to her. Of Whittaker, there had been no hint at all. Robin settled back against the cool grey stone of the theatre wall, prepared for another long day of tedium, and yawned. By late afternoon she was hot, tired, and trying not to resent her mother, who had texted repeatedly throughout the day with questions about the wedding. The last, telling her to ring the florist, who had yet another finicky question for her, arrived just as Robin had decided she needed something to drink. Wondering how Linda would react if she texted back and said she decided to have plastic flowers everywhere, on her head, in her bouquet, all over the church, anything to stop having to make decisions, she crossed to the chip shop, which sold chilled fizzy drinks. She had barely touched the door handle when somebody collided with her, also aiming for the chip shop door. Sorry, said Robin automatically, and then, oh my God. Stephanie's face was swollen and purple, one eye almost entirely closed. The impact had not been hard, but the smaller girl had been bounced off her. Robin reached out to stop her stumbling.
Jesus, what happened?
She spoke as though she knew Stephanie. In a sense, she felt she did. Observing the girl's little routines, becoming familiar with her body language, her clothing, and her liking for Coke, had fostered a one-sided sense of kinship. Now she found it natural and easy to ask a question hardly any British stranger would ask of another. Are you all right? How she managed it, Robin hardly knew. But 2 minutes later, she was settling Stephanie into a chair in the welcome shade of the stage door cafe, a few doors along from the chip shop. Stephanie was obviously in pain and ashamed of her appearance, but at the same time, she had become too hungry and thirsty to remain upstairs in the flat. Now she had simply bowed to a stronger will, thrown off balance by the older woman's solicitude, by the offer of a free meal. Robin gabbled nonsensically as she ushered Stephanie down the street, maintaining the fiction that her quixotic offer of sandwiches was due to her guilt at having almost knocked Stephanie over. Stephanie accepted a cold Fanta and a tuna sandwich with mumbled thanks. But after a few mouthfuls, she put her hand to her cheek as though in pain and set the sandwich down. Tooth? Asked Robin solicitously. The girl nodded. A tear trickled out of her unclosed eye. Who did this? Robin said urgently, reaching across the table for Stephanie's hand. She was playing a character, growing into the role as she improvised. The straw hat and the long sundress she was wearing had unconsciously suggested a hippie-ish girl full of altruism who thought that she could save Stephanie. Robin felt a tiny reciprocal squeeze of her fingers, even as Stephanie shook her head
to indicate that she was not going to give away her attacker.
"Somebody you know?" Robin whispered.
More tears rolled down Stephanie's face. She withdrew her hand from Robin's and sipped her Fanta, wincing again as the cold liquid made contact with what Robin thought was probably a cracked tooth.
"Is he your father?" Robin whispered.
It would have been an easy assumption to make. Stephanie could not possibly be older than 17. She was so thin that she barely had breasts. Tears had washed away any trace of the kohl that usually outlined her eyes. Her grubby face was infantile, with the suggestion of an overbite. But all was dominated by the purple and grey bruising. Whitaker had pummeled her until the blood vessels in her right eye had burst. The sliver that was visible was scarlet.
"No,"
whispered Stephanie.
"Boyfriend."
"Where is he?" Robin asked, reaching again for Stephanie's hand, now chilly from contact with the cold Fanta.
"Away,"
said Stephanie. "Does he live with you?" Stephanie nodded and tried to drink more Fanta, keeping the icy liquid away from the damaged side of her face.
"I didn't want him to go,"
whispered Stephanie. As Robin leaned in, the girl's restraint suddenly dissolved in the face of kindness and sugar.
"I asked to go with him, and he wouldn't take me. I know he's out tomming. I know he is. He's got someone else. I heard Banjo saying something. He's got another girl somewhere."
To Robin's disbelief, Stephanie's primary source of pain, far worse than that of her cracked tooth and her bruised and broken face, was the thought that filthy, crack-dealing Whittaker might be somewhere else, sleeping with another woman.
"I only wanted to go with him," Stephanie repeated,
and tears slid more thickly down her face, stinging that slit of an eye into a more furious redness. Robin knew that the kind, slightly dippy girl she had been impersonating would now earnestly beseech Stephanie to leave a man who had beaten her so badly. The trouble was, she was sure that would be the surest way to make Stephanie walk out on her.
"He got angry because you wanted to go with him," she repeated. "Where has he gone?" "Says he's with a cult like last. They're a band," mumbled Stephanie, wiping her nose on the back of her hand. "He rode this for him. But it's just an excuse," she said, crying harder, "to go places and find girls to fuck. I said I'd go, because last time he wanted me to, and I'd done the old band for him."
Robin did her very best not to look as though she understood what she had just been told. However, some flicker of anger and revulsion must have contaminated the look of pure kindliness she was trying to project, because Stephanie seemed suddenly to withdraw. She did not want judgment. She met that every day of her life.
"Have you been to a doctor?" Robin asked quietly. "What? No,"
said Stephanie, folding her thin arms around her torso.
"When's he due back, your boyfriend?"
Stephanie merely shook her head and shrugged. The temporary sympathy Robin had kindled between them seemed to have cooled. "The cult," said Robin, improvising rapidly, her mouth dry. "That isn't Death Cult, is it?"
"Yeah,"
said Stephanie, dimly surprised.
"Which gig? I saw them the other day."
"Don't ask me where, for God's sake."
"This was in a pub called the Green Fiddle or something. Enfield."
"Oh no, it wasn't the same gig," said Robin. "When was yours?"
"Need a pee,"
mumbled Stephanie, looking around the cafe. She shuffled off towards the bathroom. When the door had closed behind her, Robin frantically keyed search terms into her mobile. It took her several attempts to find what she was looking for. Death Cult had played a pub called the Fiddler's Green in Enfield on Saturday the 4th of June, the day before Heather Smart had been murdered.
The shadows were lengthening outside the cafe now, which had emptied apart from themselves. Evening was drawing in. The place would surely close soon.
"Cheers for the sandwich and everything," said Stephanie, who had reappeared beside her. "I'm gonna have something else, some chocolate or something," Robin urged her, even though the waitress mopping tabletops looked ready to throw them out.
"Why?" asked Stephanie, showing the first sign of suspicion.
"Because I really want to talk to you about your boyfriend," said Robin.
"Why?" repeated the teenager, a little nervous now.
"Please sit down. It isn't anything bad," Robin coaxed her. "I'm just worried about you."
Stephanie hesitated, then sank slowly back into the seat she had vacated. For the first time, Robin noticed the deep red mark around her neck.
He didn't try and strangle you, did he?" she asked.
"What?" Stephanie felt her thin neck and tears welled again in her eyes.
"Oh, that was my necklace. He give it me and then he... 'cause I ain't making enough money," she said, and began to cry in earnest. "He sold it."
Unable to think what else to do, Robin stretched her other hand across the table and held on to Stephanie's with both of her own, holding tightly, as though Stephanie were on some moving plateau that was drifting away.
"Did you say he made you with the whole band?" Robin asked quietly. "That were free," said Stephanie tearfully,
and Robin understood that Stephanie was still thinking of her money-making abilities.
"I only blew 'em."
"After the gig?" asked Robin, releasing one hand to press paper napkins into Stephanie's.
"No," said Stephanie, wiping her nose. "Next night. We stayed over in the van at the lead singer's house. He lives in Enfield."
Robin would not have believed that it was possible to feel simultaneously disgusted and delighted. If Stephanie had been with Whittaker on the night of the 5th of June, Whittaker could not have killed Heather Smart.
"Was he, your boyfriend, was he there?"
she asked in a quiet voice. "All the time, while you were, you know..."
"The fuck's going on here?"
Robin looked up. Stephanie snatched her hand away, looking frightened. Whittaker was standing over them. Robin recognized him immediately from the pictures she had seen online. He was tall and broad-shouldered, yet scrawny. His old black T-shirt was washed out almost to grey. The heretic priest's golden eyes were fascinating in their intensity. In spite of the matted hair, the sunken yellowing face, in spite of the fact that he repulsed her, she could yet feel the strange manic aura of him, a magnetic pull like the reek of carrion. He woke the urge to investigate, provoked by all dirty, rotten things, no less powerful because it was shameful.
"Who are you?"
he asked. Not aggressively, but with something close to a purr in his voice. He was looking unabashedly right down the front of her sundress.
"I bumped into your girlfriend outside the chippy," said Robin. "I bought her a drink."
"Did you now?"
"We're closing,"
said the waitress loudly. The appearance of Whittaker had been a little too much for her, Robin could tell. His flesh tunnels, his tattoos, his maniac's eyes, his smell, would be desirable in very few establishments selling food. Stephanie looked terrified, even though Whittaker was ignoring her completely. His attention was entirely focused on Robin, who felt absurdly self-conscious as she paid the bill, then stood and walked, Whittaker just behind her, out onto the street.
"Well, goodbye then," she said weakly to Stephanie.
She wished that she had Strike's courage. He had urged Stephanie to come away with him right underneath Whittaker's nose. but Robin's mouth was suddenly dry. Whittaker was staring at her